As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and today I'm once again joined by the one, the only, Mr. Sam Tai of BR and Ranks FC. Sam, thanks for being here.
Oh, no problem, buddy. Always a pleasure to jump on with you.
I did not Ron Burgundy that one. I do always write out my introduction. In this one, I had a question mark instead of an exclamation point. I'm glad I did not begin with Sam, thanks for being here. I went with the good one, I'm going to say.
Nice one, nice one. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Happy to join you.
We are going to talk about this week's Champions League games. But first, it's been a dramatic time since last we spoke. And I'm not just talking about Olympiacos getting a late winner against Marseille. You have a new show. Can you tell us a bit about what's gone on there?
It is something of a new show. Uh-huh. It's also an old show, I guess. I mean, my co-hosts, Dean and Jack, the three of us together, we were BR Football Ranks, the Bleacher Report's football soccer podcast, for close to 2 years. And Dean and Jack left the company, left Bleacher Report last month, or this month. It's been a bit of a blur, along with quite a lot of other people, actually, in something of a reshuffle. So BR are moving the football operation over to New York. If you're an aspiring social producer, there may be some jobs open. But unfortunately, quite a lot of my friends have left the company. I'm still there for now, but they dropped the podcast at least. So we were going to continue with that for sure. So we've rebadged it, as Alan Partridge would say, and we have become Ranks FC. And we're carrying on. Wednesday shows, free to access, Spotify, Apple Music, all that sort of stuff. And we're also on Patreon doing Monday and Friday drops and some newsletter stuff. So if you are a listener and you haven't already heard, obviously we're on Patreon. We'd love you to support us. We need to feed Dean's children. That's the line I'm going with. It's worked really well so far. People are just handing cash over, my guy. As soon as you start talking about feeding kids, you know, it must be the Marcus Rashford effect. A lot of good that guy's done for a lot of reasons, and he's helping me out too.
There you go. And then from a season perspective, you all do usually do your ranking system. Is it usually you who does the ranking? I feel like most of the episodes I've listened to, it's you who has the rank down or somebody else who's competing against you.
It's very rare that I don't.
Okay.
Create the ranking. Sometimes we have a guest on to rank stuff. That's cool.
Yeah.
But if it's just the three of us, if we have no guests, it's almost always me. I have to do most of the work, Taylor. This is just the way it is. I've got used to this. Every now and then we get Dean to do something in terms of a ranking. He's our transfer insider. So when it comes to the transfer window, like obviously I hand the keys over. But you know, I complain about it, but I'm quite protective over the rankings.
Yeah.
You know, it's my thing. It's my thing.
So I promise if this comes across as like a hack question, but I do mean it sincerely. Like, are you a rankings person in your like general life? Like, are you ranking your books and your favorite like tea mugs, or is it just football where you enjoy the ranking?
I'd like to think I'm not ranking everything in general sight, but yeah, I mean, I can't say that it hasn't filtered into my psyche. I do have a favorite mug, if that's what you're asking. You know,
oh, yeah?
I know exactly where I'm going for that one, and I will always look for that exact mug in the cupboard if it's not there. I'm a little bit disappointed. So, yeah, it started to happen a little bit. I mean, part of the podcast has been the nonsense rankings, which have been rebadged as gibberish rankings for legal reasons. And yeah, I've ranked everything. I've ranked pick and mix. I've ranked like Marvel characters. I've ranked superhero villains. I've ranked herbs, plants.
What's your number one? What's your number one herb?
Well, actually, that is.
The point of contention?
No, it's not a point of contention. It's unreleased. So I can't tell you because it's classified.
This is the strangest beginning to a Total Soccer show I think I've ever experienced. All right, but if you were ranking confusing seasons, where would the current one be in those rankings? Because for me, it's number one. I find myself very confused by most teams. Everyone seems simultaneously good and then also bad. Everyone seems to have too many players and then not enough players again simultaneously. How confusing has this season been for you?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty lost, mate. It's difficult. For the first time in 8 years, which is the span of my entire career in this industry, I am pretty much at a loss as to even start explaining what is happening on a pitch, and even worse, trying to predict what's going to happen on the pitch. So, you know, when we just recorded a Friday preview show for Ranks FC, which will be out on Friday, I guess, and yeah, we're talking about Clasico, we're talking Chelsea United. It's like, Sam, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know. Ask someone else. I mean, I know technically I'm paid to do this, but please don't ask me these questions. They're too difficult. What the hell is happening?
Right?
The problem is that, as you say, teams lurch and players lurch from like all-conquering performances to like bottom of the barrel rubbish from one week to the next. And there's just no rhyme or reason or rhythm to it. And I just can't wrap my head around it. Maybe some scientist out there that works for NASA has managed to model this out and has figured out the ups and downs. Maybe it is the crowds. Maybe it is coronavirus, you know, randomly wrecking starting 11s and changing plans at the last minute. I don't know, man. It's just tough, isn't it? It's much nicer to look back on football that's already happened than it is to look forward right now, which I presume is what we're going to do here. Please tell me that's the case.
Nope, we're going to look ahead because we have El Clasico this weekend. And this is what I mean when I say that it's been very confusing. I think I recorded with Graham Ruffin on Tuesday. I was pretty confident Madrid would be the stronger team heading into this weekend. Then Barcelona smash 5 past Ferencváros in a 5-1 win. Madrid lose 3-2 at home to Shakhtar and go down 3-0 inside 42 minutes to a Shakhtar team that was missing, I believe, 10 players due to COVID. So in that game, from what you saw, what went wrong for Real Madrid and why did they look so shambles when it came to defense?
Yeah, they were bad, weren't they?
Yeah.
I think this is more proof that at least as an attacking outfit, they basically cannot function without Karim Benzema, mm-hmm. who, as we know, is so heavily ingrained into this attack. He's the heartbeat of it. And the way that he drifts and creates and facilitates play as well as gets into the box and scores, he's just the clear dominant force in this attack, particularly without Eden Hazard as well. And so it looked like Real Madrid had one eye on the Clasico here with their lineup. And Luka Jovic, I really like him, but it's just not really working out for him. And part of that's his fault. Part of it's just not. Part of it is the fact that this whole team is wired to figure around Benzema. And when he's not there, they just don't know what to do. And so if you combine that kind of lackluster, kind of clueless, unscripted attack when Benzema's missing and Hazard's not there as well, and you combine it with what was essentially, let's be honest, a very good game plan from Shakhtar. I mean, yeah, sure, they sat deep and they exposed them on the counter, but they knew that they had players in midfield, particularly Marcos Antonio, who were fairly press resistant and would be able to just sideswipe a tackle and just play a runner in behind. And what Antonio did from a playmaking perspective under pressure in tight areas on the pitch in terms of creating chances and releasing runners over the top was absolutely masterful. And Tete, who did net one, the winger on the right hand side, Brazilian youth international, he should have had 4. And Antonio was robbed of at least 4 assists, in my opinion, which I'm really angry about. But Shakhtar's game plan was excellent in the first half, and they did the damage. And then they kind of had to absorb a little bit in the second half because Benzema was on. A lot of people will point the finger here and say, well, Ramos is clearly an important part of this team. And true, he is, at least emotionally. And in terms of your performance levels, even if he himself is not perfect, he obviously lifts the players around him. But I'd actually say this was more to do with Benzema not being there. Combination of Benzema and Hazard missing, terrible.
And still, though, like, yes, I think Sergio Ramos not being there definitely critical because he elevates that team. But you would still think that Rafael Varane could get a job done. You think that Eder Militao could step up and do an okay job. Instead, Varane gets the own goal. Militao looking, I think, shambles. I'm going to use that word for the second time in as many minutes.
Bit shaky.
Yeah. There we go.
And also Ferland Mendy at right back. Mm-hmm. I love Mendy, but he's obviously not a right back. Like, he's extremely left-footed and he's better defensively than he is offensively. Yeah. I think he's really solid. I really can't state how much I like him. Like, he's really good, but there was no balance to the attack either. So you've lost you've lost Benzema, you've lost Hazard. You're fragile through the center because you don't have your defensive leader there, and you've got no real balance up the right hand side, and no kind of authoritative playmakers and forwards to really grab the ball by the horns. And one of the beautiful things about what Modric did was Modric was able to come on and basically, again, just sidestep a marker and just slam it into the net. And up until that point, they just really hadn't had anything like that, anything that was able to break Shakhtar down. And on the reverse end, they were awful. So 3-0, half time. Oh, bloody hell. Mm. I mean, the only thing more shocking was that Vinicius managed to score within about 10 seconds of coming on.
So, yes, Vinicius scores. Karim Benzema, I believe, does not, but is obviously instrumental in that comeback. Such as it was, they still lose. We're going to go with a loose rankings theme here. If you're ranking players who are, like, most similar to him in terms of skill set, who would be at least in, like, the top three of that list? Not necessarily number one, but basically if Real Madrid wanted to sort of replicate what he does with a younger player, if they wanted to sort of kind of bring in a replacement who can do a similar thing, who should they look to?
I mean, this is very, very difficult, because what Benzema is the complete footballer, and he is, like, equal parts false nine and facilitator and equal parts finisher. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think another Benzema really exists. Mm-hmm. And that's where their problem is. Luka Jovic could barely be more different, as kind of like a penalty box instincts kind of guy. I think he's got the mentality to play for Real Madrid. I think he's got the ice in the veins finishing stuff. It's just the rest of the game that's so different to Benzema. The team just can't latch onto him properly. And for Benzema to replace Benzema, like, the closest fit I can think of is Firmino. Who isn't as good, and is definitely not as good at finishing. And then beyond that, I mean, Kai Havertz would have been a good shout, but not anymore.
Yeah,
because he's gone. I can't think of anybody else, dude.
So is the answer then? You think if they're gonna like rebuild, it does require a change in the approach. You basically can't just keep doing what they're doing and hope that somebody does what Benzema does. You have to like reconfigure things a little bit.
Probably, yeah. I think you just have to rewire it. And I don't think that can possibly happen until Benzema's gone. That's the problem. So ideally, you get another Benzema. But as I've just said, like, I can't think of anybody that would be up to Real Madrid standards that would be okay with playing second fiddle and has the skill set that Benzema offers in the grand scale. It just doesn't exist.
Let's get Edinson Cavani in there and see what happens. How about that?
He would have been fine. Like, he's good, right? But hey, you guys got him.
So looking at this weekend, then, are you with me that like it? Not even are you with me, but it seemed to me that Barcelona maybe were looking a little bit more vulnerable than Real Madrid. Now I'm not so sure. They, as I said, blow away Fenerbahce. Gerard Piqué does get the red card, although that doesn't factor into this weekend. What are your expectations for this Clásico?
Finally, a good Clásico. Because it's been a while, I think, is the main thing. This fixture has actually really, really disappointed me on a number of occasions recently. It doesn't have the compelling Messi-Ronaldo vibe. It doesn't have the Guardiola-Mourinho vibe. So the narratives are lacking. But also, I think there's like these teams are not on the top of the world right now. And ultimately, it's been a bit like the quality almost hasn't been there at times. But now that they're both sufficiently fragile and damaged and equally so, but will both probably fancy themselves for the win. I think this shapes out to be, first and foremost, a good old game of football, Taylor.
You think?
And, oh yeah, absolutely. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
That makes me really happy. We in the Tuesday show, were sort of agreeing that it might be a little bit dull because of the uncertainty about these teams. So I'm excited to hear you take a more optimistic approach.
Yeah, maybe that's just my natural demeanor,
that's
Taylor.
Fine.
My natural disposition.
That's a good demeanor
compared to yours. But it's I think it's going to be all right. I think it's going to be all right. And I actually have Barca having the edge going into this one, only slightly. Real Madrid consecutive losses obviously figures into that. But I'm just looking at Barca's ability to change the game off the bench, and I'm seeing quite a lot more versatility there. I've quite liked quite a lot of what Barca have managed to put on the table so far this early this season, although I did watch them play Getafe at the weekend, and that wasn't great, and almost contradictory to my point 10 seconds ago against Getafe when they were 1-0 down. They just threw attacker on after attacker after attacker and didn't really seem to like know what to do with them. They were just like, if we put another one on, we might score. And there wasn't a lot of thought behind it, and it didn't really work out for them. But Getafe are like, they're just like a different animal, aren't they? They're so frustrating to play that Real Madrid will be open enough for Barca to be able to change that game. So I've predicted a Barca win, really, but like I could easily see this being 2-2. It's hard to split these two.
All right, so we shall see what happens this coming weekend. For now, let's talk about some games that have already happened. Let's go to Ajax's 1-0 loss at home to Liverpool, the courtesy of a Nico Taliafico own goal, which is something that Serginho Dest would never have done and never would do. So that transfer makes all the more sense. The big narrative this week heading into this game and coming out of this game has been what Jurgen Klopp will do with Virgil van Dijk now out, likely for the rest of the season. Do you like that Gomez-Fabinho partnership? Do you think that is the solution, or do you think they're going to spend some money in January?
I think they'll probably see how it goes. I mean, look, we saw it in the summer how they were very reluctant to spend big money on anybody, and they let Timo Werner go to Chelsea. They let a couple of other targets slip through. I mean, they did a really good job haggling through for Tsimikas and Thiago, to be fair, but they weren't willing to spend, and I don't think that changes in January. That's not how the accountancy books work. So I think they're probably hoping that Fabinho is Van Dijk but bold and Brazilian, so but he does look very very smooth, doesn't he? He does look good at centre half. Impressed against Ajax, and a couple of weeks ago when he dropped in against Chelsea there, he absolutely handled Timo Werner. Like, Timo Werner, who was notoriously difficult to keep track of and so fast, Fabinho just handled him. Like, it didn't look very difficult for him. He is one of the more graceful leggy players that I think I've ever seen, and it looks like he can drop in and play. Now, Gomez and Matip have, I think they've literally never started a game together. So that is an interesting new partnership, despite the fact that they've been on the books at Liverpool for like 2 or 3 years each. And I do wonder if the partnership is actually Fabinho-Matip, because Gomez has been a bit off colour, I would say, since probably June. I think his post-lockdown form wasn't great, and he's obviously had a few issues early this season. The Villa game was really, really poor, and he got hooked after an hour. It wasn't just him, of course. It was pretty much everybody. But I think it works. I think it has the bones of something quite good, but it really relies on Fabinho being that dominant force, stepping in for Van Dijk. And I think the partnership is probably Fabinho-Matip when Matip's fit.
I would say the first couple of minutes of this game justified that, as I think Joe Gomez was trying to shepherd a ball out to kind of like shield it off so Adrian could come out and collect it. And instead there's a miscommunication. It just ends up getting booted to the stands. And right there it felt like, ooh, that's maybe something that wouldn't have happened if Virgil van Dijk were around. But then the rest of the game, like, it plays out as you'd expect in that Liverpool get the win, but not the most exciting of results. Jurgen Klopp afterwards complains about the field, takes off, I think Henderson at halftime takes off the entire front three in the 60th minute because we still have 5 subs in Europe. So not the most exciting game, not the game that I expected it to be. So instead, what I am going to ask you, watching that Ajax team, it was a lot of names I was somewhat familiar with and then a few names that I was less familiar with. Who on that team, or who like that played in this game, or just in Ajax in general, are you thinking will be the kind of next big name, the next Donny van de Beek, the next Frankie de Jong, Matthias de Ligt, that style of player?
Yeah, there's still a couple that I'm getting to grips with as well. It changes fast at Ajax because they have to settle their players all the time, so you just have to keep on top of it. But the season's only just started, so we do need a bit more time. But
yeah.
I mean, honestly, the most exciting one for me is the player that Fabinho appears to have broken, which would be Mohamed Kudus. So bit of a counterintuitive selection, since you literally can't watch him play for the next 2 or 3 months. He's got meniscus damage, and I don't know how long he's going to be out for, but it is months. But Kudus early this season has been a bit of a revelation, and his ball carrying ability, and again, that smoothness to his play and his ability to transition from defense to attack and appear pretty damn close to perfect in terms of press resistance. I've been very, very impressed with him playing as an 8 or a 10 and whatever position, really. He's been a bit of a star, plucked from relative obscurity, really, in Scandinavia in the summer. But a lot of analytics people that I knew were raving about him, and Ajax took the plunge, although it's not really much of a plunge if you can see the talent. And Gravenberch in central midfield is the other one. Very, very young, but again, another good roaming number 8. Needs to develop a few kinks in his game, maybe their defensive awareness and a few things like that. But he's very, very young, and he's going to grow into this team and grow into this season. And he's very exciting. I think physically, as a prospect, he looks really, really, he looks like he could become quite the imperious player. So I'd say Gravenberch and Kudus are the two that I'm really keeping an eye on. And I'm going to keep it as a ranking. Kudus 1, Gravenberch 2. And he's not really that much of a secret, but Lisandro Martinez continues to impress me no matter which position he's in, whenever he plays. He is more last season's story, but I think he's still one of those players that even this summer, if you were like, I don't think a top club would have paid, you know, 40 million for Lisandro Martinez, but next summer that might be different.
More still to come from my conversation with Sam Tai, but first I wanted to let you know that today's episode of the Total Soccer Show is brought to you by Manscaped. We know now that Jurgen Klopp was not pleased with the field when Liverpool played Ajax. He thought it was not, I guess, well-maintained. If the folks at Manscaped had been in charge, you can see where I'm going with this, it probably would have been, especially if they had utilized something like the Premium Lawnmower 3.0, which is a perfect trimmer that is waterproof, includes an LED light, and is made with advanced skin-safe technology. You would need several of those to trim an entire field, but they would do it, and they would do it precisely. For a limited time, when you order the Perfect Package Kit, which includes their Manscaped Crop Preserver, as well as the Crop Reviver, which is a toning spray, both are super practical and smell great. When you purchase that, you get 2 free gifts, the Shed Travel Bag and the Manscaped Anti-Chafing Boxer Briefs. They are anti-chafing, cooling, and are very, very comfortable as well. That's a good combination of things. The waistband is also super elastic to reduce chafing and rubbing. So if you're playing in even more unfavorable conditions, if it's a bad field, but also if it's super hot or raining or anything like that, you're not going to get uncomfortable because the boxer briefs will keep you quite relaxed. You can get 20% off with free shipping with the code TSS20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com using the code TSS20. From the moose to the caboose, always use the right tools for the job, and maybe don't use them to trim an entire field, but you can if you want. Thank you very much to Manscaped for sponsoring this episode. Now back to Sam Tai.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Since you've continued the ranking narrative, where are Liverpool in terms of if you're ranking teams most likely to be in the Champions League final or win the Champions League this season?
Oh, mate, I don't do those predictions at this stage. The Champions League predictions, the winners and all that stuff, I have a very strict rule, which I'm allowed to continue to enforce. I don't do it before Christmas.
All right. But then, like, Boxing Day, are those rankings out?
No, as in, basically, let's get the group stage done. Let's see what the lie of the land is. Because also, I'm sure you remember, but, like, do you remember when the first time Man United beat PSG? Not this time, the other time. When the draw came out and they drew each other in the round of 16, Man United were a total mess.
Yeah.
PSG were in the ascendancy. And this had, 4-1, 5-1 written all over it. 3 months passed, we get to February, PSG are an absolute mess and United are on fire. Rio Ferdinand shouting about giving Ole a contract, United a back baby, woohoo, all that stuff. So much changes between December and February. I tell you what, even more changes between September and February. So I just basically, I dodged the question like a coward because I just don't know.
No, you didn't dodge the question. You gave a realistic answer, which I think is probably better than just coming up with something on the fly, because to really further your point, we talked about this last time. I think we talk about it every time you're on, but we were at the Bayern Munich game where they get destroyed by Eintracht Frankfurt. And if we asked you then, hey, how far are Bayern going to go? I feel like the answer would be not very far. And yet now we know they are more than capable of going far. They also are more than capable of, I'm going to say embarrassing, Atletico Madrid, a 4-0 win for Bayern Munich. The game was pretty open, pretty sloppy for the first 30 minutes or so. Then Bayern did Bayern things, or Bayern did Bayern things, not Bayern things. Those would be very different things. I did an episode of Soccer 101 on why Bayern Munich are so good. We've talked about them many, many times on this show. I am still sort of amazed by results like this because Atleti are so difficult to play against. They are so compact and troublesome, but then good on the counter. And yet Bayern Munich still able to get these results. And all of that is to say, like, I am assuming there will be a period in which Bayern Munich are not this level of dominant. It has to happen. You have to have your ups and downs so that you rebuild and then you come back. If Bayern Munich do start to have another downturn in form, what do you think is the precipitating incident? Who is the player that you think, similar to Benzema, they would struggle the most to replace? I feel like I've teed you up to say Robert Lewandowski, and I didn't really mean to. But yeah, what does it look like if Bayern Munich start to fall off a little?
I mean, this is a hell of a way of talking about Bayern after winning 4-0. Hey, let's talk about what could their downfall be.
I mean, we just talk about how good they are so often. It's like we can go through the individual moments of like, oh, this combination, the way that player moved there. I would love to do all of that. It's just it ends up being the same sort of, yeah, they're just really good and they've got a lot of talent and they know how to play. And Hansi Flick seems to have figured that out. I have more questions about that later on. But for now, yeah, I want to go negative first.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the answer is Lewandowski. I think we've actually got enough evidence over the course of 2020 of Bayern racking up 4, 5, 6 goals against teams and Lewandowski either scoring just one or none at all. And if it's one, it's like the 4th or 5th goal. Like, obviously, he's an incredible number nine. I think he's the best number nine in the world. And I don't mean to disrespect him. But when Bayern rack up huge scorelines, they don't need Lewandowski to score to do it. Now, you could argue that the rest of what he offers in terms of link play and facilitating, like Benzema, maybe that's absolutely crucial, even if he's not scoring, which is probably true. But I actually think right now the real standout candidate for me is Thomas Müller and what he's managed to do over the course of last season, leaping to the top of the assist charts. I think he got 21 and beat Sancho. What Hansi Flick has unlocked in Thomas Müller, I think he's actually the wild card in the system. Because Bayern, for all their flash and for all their speed, and ultimately for all their close to footballing perfection, they can settle into periods in games where they become a bit mechanical. And there is only one player that could break them out of that and create something completely different and off script. And that is Müller. And I think he's the most irreplaceable player in the system. Because they've got loads of really good players, but they've got great depth as well. So they're not struggling to replace too many players. But I don't think there's another player like Müller in the world. So there's definitely not one at Bayern.
You said Hansi Flick has sort of unlocked him a little bit. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I wanted to ask what you mean by that in terms of, have you seen him get like specific things out of Thomas Müller? Have you seen him adjust his game at all?
No, I think unlocked maybe is the wrong word. It's maybe like re-energized or reignited, because what we're seeing from Müller isn't something we haven't seen in the past. It's just something we haven't seen for a couple of years, you know, basically the Kovac years and just before that. Even under Pep, he wasn't this good. I mean, perhaps I'd argue that this is at least his second best streak ever, which is the other one being the 2013 treble win into the World Cup. But this might be the best we've literally ever seen from Thomas Müller. And it is that kind of classic kind of Raumdeuter space interpretation, the kind of the wild card effect he has on a game where he just roams and goes off position. And the link up play that he has with all the different players, his ability to play first time passes and balls, his strange ability to look like he's mishit a shot so badly he's an amateur, but it goes in the top corner. All of these things are so different to what anybody else can do.
Yep.
That's why I pick him. And so unlocked is not right. Reignited is the right way of putting it.
With the rest of the team, are there specific things you've seen that Hansi Flick has done? Because I think it's very easy with Bayern Munich to say, as I kind of already have, like, oh, they've got so much talent, they've got the money, they've got the name recognition, they're always going to be this dominant team in Germany, and then they're able to extend that to the Champions League. So all you got to do is get Hansi Flick in and like just make everybody happy, and then it's all good. But we know from Niko Kovac that there are certainly managers who cannot do that. So I then look at Hansi Flick and wonder, like, what are the individual things that you might have seen, or even just kind of broader perspective things that you think he has gotten right that has allowed Bayern to be this good?
I mean, I think the first step with Bayern, I think I actually talked about it last time I was on the show, but if you make Neuer and Müller happy, then you have a much better time of things.
Yeah.
And he was able to figure that out pretty damn quickly. I mean, Flick was the assistant coach for Germany at 2014, so he knows how these players work, and he knows what the dynamic at Bayern Munich is, no question, having been an assistant before he took the helm. So Neuer and Müller happy is happy days for a coach. Kovac missed that boat. He didn't do that, and that was his first problem. But a couple of things I've definitely picked out are that Bayern are outstanding from set pieces, both defensively and offensively. They are so, so good at them. And with Kimmich moving into central midfield, they just feel like a different animal. Kimmich is, we're close to talking about Kimmich as top three central midfielders in the world at this point. I mean, maybe we're not close, maybe we're already there. Like, the guy is astonishing. It feels like there are 10 of him, and yet everything he does like he's doing it at 50% speed because he's so good and so calm.
The opening goal, I have to interject, but yeah, that opening goal, if ever you needed an example of why he is so good and simultaneously everybody's frustrations with João Félix, it's right there. It's a loose ball. Kimmich goes all in for the tackle. João Félix hurdles that tackle. Kimmich gets up and plays that ball into Kingsley Coman. Yeah, I'm with you. Joshua Kimmich, an incredibly good footballer. Maybe one of the top midfielders in the world for me.
I hadn't thought about it too much, but he's in that conversation for sure. The guy is astonishing. And the other thing I would say is that, like, obviously they're a devastating attacking force and they throw bodies forward and they are so fast when they move forward. It's incredible. In transition, Bayern are just incredible. But going backwards the other way, recovering from that transition, this is something that a lot of the top teams basically aren't nailing right now, but Bayern are. You watch when Bayern lose the ball in an attacking area and they look like they could be exposed. They run back so goddamn fast. Like, the recovery speed and the effort is remarkable. I remember watching them post-lockdown in a couple of games against Gladbach and against Leverkusen, and they'd lose the ball, and 3 seconds later, they'd have eight men behind the ball on their own edge of their own box. These are all extremely talented players. They're top of the range. They're world-class, and yet they're also so well-conditioned and aware enough and willing to chase back and do the dirty work. Like, every single one of them will do it. They'll all stand on their own goal line and take a ball to the balls if they need to, just to prevent a goal being scored. It sounds basic, but like, no one else is doing that. Like, no one else has that commitment from their players. Barcelona certainly don't. That's why the disparity was so stark when they played each other. It's a different world what Bayern are doing.
You would think Atletico Madrid would have that same level of discipline when it comes to defending and transitioning to defense. They did not really against Bayern Munich. Generally speaking, they still haven't lost in the league so far, 2 wins and 2 draws. We did have this question. I say all that just to say this isn't necessarily coming from this result, but last week we had a question about if Diego Simeone were to leave Atletico Madrid, what would be the ideal job for him right now, either at club or at international level? I gave my answer. Ryan gave his answer. Ryan's was Arsenal for reasons. Mine was Wolves. I'm wondering if you have a thought on where you would like to see Diego Simeone, if not at Atletico Madrid.
What, right now or like towards the end of the season or something like that?
I think, like, basically which team with like the roster they have would embrace his philosophy, his style of play. Where would he be able to have success?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because I'm sure you talked about this when you actually asked the question and decided it, but they're a bit of an anachronism, aren't they, in world football at the top level? Like, they don't really play in the same way as most others. So it is quite difficult to envisage him walking into another top team and going, right, this is how we're going to do things. So you imagine Diego Simeone getting Neymar at PSG to be like, okay, so we're going to track back first and foremost, and then you can maybe think about doing some dribbles. He'd be like, get out of here.
That genuinely, just the idea of that really did make me laugh. So thank you for that.
I mean, I'm looking at a Premier League table right now, and the team that would suit them the most is Crystal Palace.
Wow.
You're not wrong. Crystal Palace.
That is a great shout.
Because Hodgson is basically a poor man Simeone, and he's built a team that would really, really suit him. Wilfred Zaha becomes João Félix, and everybody else becomes hard worker number 1 through to 10. So actually the best fit I can think of is Palace.
I know exactly what you mean.
It's definitely not the answer that you wanted.
No, it's just hysterical to me because, first of all, it's a great answer, but second of all, I know what you mean, you are correct, but the idea that Roy Hodgson and Diego Simeone are like cut from the same cloth is hysterical to me, and I'm all about it, and I want Uncle Roy to start wearing all black suits at all times.
Okay, here's a slightly better answer. Sevilla would suit him.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
Yeah, we'll go with Sevilla, not Palace. Right.
Since you mentioned PSG, they do lose at home 2-1 to Manchester United. Marcus Rashford scoring the winner there. Marcus Rashford, despite how much I have watched of him for Manchester United, remains a confusing figure to me, or at least a confusing attacker, because he will have moments where he has very clear-cut chances that he doesn't take. He has times when he shoots, at least to my mind, that he has really no business shooting. Like, I appreciate the effort, I appreciate the sort of confidence, but it never seems like he's going to score. And then from like a 0-degree angle in like the dying moments, he's able to hit one inch perfect. Like, how confused are you by Marcus Rashford? Or more maybe like specifically, is that determination, is that like willingness to try stuff and keep going, even if you've missed sitters earlier, you find a way to make something happen. Is that a skill set, or is that like just sort of the law of averages eventually catching up?
I mean, all top attackers miss a chance and then instantly forget it ever happened. That's just the way their brains work. So Rashford is no different. Rashford is still a little bit rough around the edges, isn't he? Ultimately, I mean, I think if it really ever finally fully clicked for Rashford, I actually don't think he'd look too dissimilar to Mbappe. Like, because stylistically, he could be that kind of player. Now, unfortunately, he's not quite Mbappe, but he's pretty damn good in his own right. And you have to take the rough with the smooth with Rashford. He's a direct player. He takes players on, and he takes on risks and he takes chances. And ultimately, that can get a bit frustrating. But if you watch a team full of players that don't do that, they don't get anywhere at all. And I guess United's problem may be, I say problem, they just beat PSG away, is that Martial is also similarly perplexing at times.
Yep.
And you've basically got two of them, haven't you? Mm-hmm. Two players that kind of swing wildly from 0 to 100
it's
at any given moment.
It's super fun and not at all infuriating at times.
I mean, Rashford's had an injury, and yeah, I've been willing to give him some grace period, basically since June, because he came back from that back injury. I was actually within the day before that got announced, by the way. I was in his house.
Wait,
it wasn't
before,
me.
Before it was announced that he had a broken back?
Yeah.
But it wasn't you. You're sure?
I swear to God, it wasn't me.
Was he like holding his back the whole time? Like, were there signs?
No, he was completely fine. We did a house tour, which is on YouTube, which you could just search Marcus Rashford house tour. And basically he showed me around his house, which was very nice of him. But we...
It was like a lot of legwork to not call it cribs, just saying that.
We went to... yeah, for sure. But I don't think we're allowed to. Before we did that, we met at Hotel Football because Rashford spoke to Ryan Giggs for basically a trip down memory lane for half an hour or so on Manchester United stuff, which was really nice. And at the top of Hotel Football, which for those of you who don't know, is the hotel basically directly opposite Old Trafford. And a lot of football fans obviously stay there the night before or the night of the game to go to Old Trafford and make a real thing of it. It's a really nice hotel. And the very top floor, there is a five-a-side pitch. And the interview took place on the five-a-side pitch. And I was doing kick-ups with Marcus Rashford that day, and then he drove me to his house, and then we had a house tour, and he was fine. He was absolutely fine. I met his dogs. They're delightful. And the next day, he'd been ruled out for several months with a spinal injury, and I tell you what, I was as surprised as anybody, because the guy looked fine to me.
But you did do keepy ups.
Yeah, and he did them too. And we were passing.
I'm just saying, maybe that's where it happened, Sam. Maybe you do share more of the responsibility here than you're letting on.
Maybe. I'm really sorry if I do.
Wait,
but yeah, that was
go ahead.
That was really surprising when that happened. So yeah, there were some interesting reports as well that came out of that after that. I wasn't really sure about those. Like, there was a report in one newspaper that said that Rashford had done an interview with Giggs earlier that day, earlier the day before in Hotel Football, and he couldn't sit down because he was in so much pain and he was holding his back. Absolute bollocks. Like, I can't believe how much that of a lie that is. He was fine. It was a weird day. It was a weird couple of days.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
But I can't let go of the keepy uppies for a moment here. When you're doing those with Marcus Rashford, like, what is your approach, Sam Tai? Like, were you trying to impress? Were you just trying to go along? Were you the workmanlike number 8 who was just getting the ball back to him? Were you trying to be the number 10? Were you the number 6 who was taking one touch and playing it right back? What were you going with?
4 touches max.
All right.
Get it back.
All right. No flair.
Get it back without booting it at his knees. I mean, I was wearing shoes that were absolutely not meant for football at all.
Excuses.
So I was just like, flick it up, 1, 2, 3, pass it over. 1, 2, 3, pass it over. Like, just don't embarrass yourself. Just be cool, be calm, be collected. No problem. And it was fine. I was able to do that. I was able to transfer in the ball 2 or 3 times. No problems. Didn't make myself look a fool. But he doesn't think I'm anything special either. So perfect middle ground.
That is the perfect middle ground. Manchester United do have more players than Marcus Rashford. You mentioned Anthony Martial. He's one of them. Axel Tuanzebe is also one of them, put in a solid shift against PSG. Oh, how much have you seen of him, Sam? Because I would say you're sort of a Tuanzebe originalist.
I believe I'm the founder of the Tuanzebe fan club, and I'm in control of the memberships. Did you want one?
Yeah, I think I'm in.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I saw a lot of him as I was covering Villa when they in the season they got promoted. So he spent. I'll just have a quick look at the history there because it was a good. He did half a season under Steve Bruce, but he only made like 4 appearances and he got injured and missed the rest of the season. But he stuck around for another one and he made 27 starts in the Championship. Again, he got injured during that time. I think he broke his foot and missed 3 months. And then he came back in time for the playoff push and started the playoff final at Wembley. He and Tyrone Mings as a partnership were just unbelievable at that level. Like, it was a particular game. It was actually the game that you might remember this, where Villa played Leeds and Leeds tricked Villa into thinking they were going to pass the ball out of play for an injury, waited for them to stop, and then played it through the lines and scored. And Bielsa went nuts and forced his team to concede a goal to restore parity. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was incredible. So then later on in that game, Villa got a red card and they were down to 10. 1-1, 70 minutes, absolute Leeds United onslaught from a Bielsa side. And Tuanzebe and Mings were just incredible. They were pillars. They were incredible at the heart of that defence. I remember coming away from that game thinking these two are just like, they're mid-table Premier League class at the absolute worst. They are just so good. And with Tuanzebe, it's just such a shame that his only enemy is his own body, and he just can't seem to get onto the pitch for long at all before breaking down again. And his performance against PSG, I mean, I didn't watch the game in full, but I'm dutifully informed by everybody in my phone book that he was amazing. Yep. And it was his first start in 10 months, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. I was very impressed by him. I'm going to ask you another sort of rankings question, but with the caveat that you said you don't want to jump to conclusions based on our small sample size. But even maybe going back to last season, if you are coming up with like a starting 11 for Manchester United and they're playing in a back 4, who would be the 2 center backs you would go with if everybody's fully fit?
Well, right now I'd absolutely take Tuanzebe. Like, at Villa, he only really had one weakness, and that was he was actually surprisingly poor at judging long balls, which is a bit weird, but he continually kind of overshot them and went forward and missed them, or was far too cautious and allowed it to bounce and allowed the striker to get in on him. And he had real trouble just dealing with those direct balls forward, which, as you can imagine, in the Championship, there were quite a lot of them. But everything else was completely fine. Defending crosses, fine. On the ball, really smooth. All the mechanics were there. All the fundamentals were there, except for that one thing. Now, let's be honest, he hasn't really played that much since he played the playoff final against Derby a couple of years ago now. So how much time he's had to work on those, I don't know. But that's very coachable. Like, that doesn't take very long at all. So I would put Tuanzebe in and say, let's see if he can stay fit, because if he can, you've got a potentially special player on your hands. I'm of the opinion that Maguire needs probably a little bit of a break. So I guess I'm ending up with Lindelof. Did that sound convincing?
That, as I said in the beginning, when I had a question mark instead of an exclamation point, that sounds like you had a period or maybe an ellipses instead of anything resembling an exclamation point.
I just didn't want to say it, but I don't know what else to say. I mean, the answer is Chris Smalling, but he's gone.
Yeah.
So he's gone. So I guess it's, yeah. I mean, look, in a month's time, it would be Tuanzebe and Maguire. I think Maguire just needs to step out for a little bit. So for now, it's Lindelof and Tuanzebe.
All right. Well, my Man United rage has been triggered, so let's just move on to another game. Inter Milan pulled a point back with a late equalizer from Romelu Lukaku in their 2-2 draw at home to Borussia Mönchengladbach. Inter Milan with Antonio Conte, I feel like you can safely assume they're going to be in a back three. There's going to be a lot of fight and tenacity to that team. Borussia Mönchengladbach are one of those teams that I always plan to cover and really focus in on, and then I sort of never do. I'm hoping you have, and I'm wondering who on that squad you particularly enjoy watching.
Yeah, I did watch this game. This game was the second half of this game, I can only implore you to go and watch the second half of this game. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. I'll do a rough talking through of it because it was a goalless first half and really genuinely not that much happened. Lukaku puts Inter ahead. In the build-up,
in the most scrambly scramble of all goals.
It was scrambly McScramble face for sure. But in the build-up to the goal, there is a pass from Arturo Vidal that is very similar to the one that Joshua Kimmich played to Kingsley Coman.
Yeah.
And it was a beautifully flighted ball that it's not converted, but the ball kind of works its way back around. D'Ambrosio keeps it in. Someone swipes at it. Lukaku puts it in the net. That's the kind of panache that Vidal can offer. Then, 14 minutes later, Vidal goes through someone's legs and concedes a penalty. And I was like, ah, of course. The 15 minutes that perfectly encapsulates Arturo Vidal's entire career is, on the one hand, brilliant. On the one hand, a total liability. Ben Sabaini converts to Penn, who is a really good left wing back. He's actually the player that in an article this summer I said Inter should sign for left wing back because he's that kind of more modern, 5'11", 6 foot build, taller wing back that runs with a lot of power, with that big stride that can cover the flank up and down. He can also play left centre back, actually, where Inter are playing Kolarov, and that is not going particularly well at all from what I've seen. But Kolarov is frankly too old to play wing back, so I don't know what the plan was there, but it doesn't seem to be working. But later on, there was a pass from Neuhaus. Have you seen it?
I watched this game, but I'm not remembering it now.
Oh my God. The pass from Neuhaus is just ridiculous. It's in the build up to the second goal for Gladbach, 84th minute. Do you remember that Benjamin Pavard pass that did the rounds on Twitter a couple of years ago where he was playing centre back and he did that low grass cutter and it bypassed an entire team and went through for someone on goal? Neuhaus basically did this. I counted six players that it beat. First time, skimmer, power along the floor, broke three lines, beat six players, and set Hoffman off to score a goal. He nutmegged Handanovic and put it in. And there's me screaming at the TV, you better score this. you have no choice but to score this because that pass was it belongs in a museum. And if you mess this up, Jonas Hoffman, if you mess this up, you will be public enemy number one of football. Because this pass needs to be remembered appropriately as an assist and not just some random pass in the 84th minute of a group stage game in the craziest season of all time. And then Gladbach can't get themselves in gear. They can't defend the late pressure. And eventually Lukaku converts at the back post, gets away from Elvedi and pushes it over the line. Bastoni, I think, gets a near post flick. This 35 minutes of football was just, it was like watching an entire match of the day in terms of highlights. It was just incredible. So much fun to watch. And Inter are actually, again, we put them in the same category as Barca, United, Chelsea, Real Madrid. They look more fragile than I anticipated right now.
I agree. Yeah.
And I'm surprised by it. I'm not going to blame it all on Kolarov, but I am going to say that he's a major part of that. But De Vrij hasn't looked quite so good. Conte definitely is at fault here. Obviously, you lose Hakimi to coronavirus. So, for the match, that's not helpful. And definitely a part of these struggles are these just random, oh, you can't play.
Yep.
Oh, he's gone. So that's a problem. But Inter, more fragile than I thought. Gladbach, still loads of fun. Marcus Thuram, player. Mbolo is the number 10 now, feeding chances rather than struggling to score goals under a lot of pressure as the number 9. There's a lot to like here. Gladbach are high pressing. Marco Rosa came from the Red Bull tree, so you know exactly what to expect from him. And they're good fun. They're still good fun.
Looking at the Inter Milan side for a moment, it didn't really occur to me until this exact moment. The left side of Inter yesterday was Alexis Sanchez up top. I think they have Perisic as a wingback winger. Yep. Vidal was the left-sided midfielder, and that left Kolarov as your left center back. That's rough times. That's a veteran squad, not to be ageist. I just don't know if that's the team that I would necessarily have expected them to bring out in the Champions League and expected them to get a result.
Yeah, I don't really get it. Like Perisic left wing back, Kolarov left center back. It just doesn't really do anything for me. And I like the rest of this team a lot. So this is quite disappointing. I'd also just draw a parallel there with what Juventus put up against Dynamo Kiev. I mean, they beat Kiev 2-0, so no problem. But they started the game with Chiesa at left wing back, which is essentially like having Perisic at left wing back. I know Perisic is pretty two-footed, so it's okay. But a right-footed wing back at left wing back is crazy. And they had Danilo at left centre back with Chiellini in the middle and Bonucci on the right. I was like, Pirlo, do you know what foot these players use? Like, you played with two of them. Like, what's going on? I don't get it. I don't understand. I mean, maybe he thinks that Bonucci's passing range can be unlocked a little bit when he plays on the right of the three because you get that pocket of space to move into. Maybe he doesn't trust Chiellini's pace in the channel on the left because he's 35, 36, whatever it is. Maybe it's just an age thing. But to play Danilo at left centre back left me jaw dropped. I don't like him. So I don't like him as a player. So I don't like it whenever he features in Juventus' starting lineup, to be honest with you. I don't think he's very good. But to see him at left centre back was really alarming. It was even scarier than, well, if you've been playing Warzone recently, the Halloween edition of that is quite scary. The zombies and ghosts and everything. And I was even more scared of this.
I love you, Sam. I really do. I did watch this game. This was the second Champions League game that put me to sleep this week. So maybe I need to drink some more coffee before the Champions League happens. But yeah, twice I thought, oh, Dynamo Kiev, they're always kind of a surprising team. You never know what you're going to expect. Juventus, this should be a good one. And then it was not. At least the first 45 minutes were not. But Juve do eventually get two goals from, I believe, Alvaro Morata to get the win there. The last game I wanted to ask you about would be Chelsea-Sevilla. Because again, I don't really know what to make of this one. It's a 0-0 draw. And yet I wouldn't say this was necessarily like boring in the way some of the other games I think kind of were. But Sevilla are just a very difficult side right now. They're very tricky. A goalless draw, though, is probably not what Chelsea fans would have wanted from this one, especially given the investment in that squad. Are you like, do you think Chelsea fans should be okay with a result like this against Sevilla, or could they have done more? Should they have done more?
I mean, surely they're just delighted with a clean sheet.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's a trade-off here, and I didn't see this game in full, but you can tell from six shots to five that maybe this wasn't lighting anyone's screen up.
Nah.
So, yeah, fair enough. Sevilla, extremely obstinate to play against when they want to be very, very well put together side. I mean, Granada still beat them at the other week, so still pretty pleased with that one. But yeah, for most teams, Sevilla are a problem. Chelsea just picking up that clean sheet, I'm sure will do them wonders. And you know, to get a goalkeeper keep a clean sheet to more or less shut Sevilla down, I would be walking away with this as, I know it's a small positive, and maybe it's like, you know, they need to be aiming higher than this. But after the start to the season they've had and the goals they've conceded, I'd just be pretty pleased with this. I'd take it and run.
So I feel like I've asked you some like sort of negative questions. I want to end on a positive, or at least attempt to. With that result, we do have no goals, but Frank Lampard keeps that clean sheet. What have you liked from Frank Lampard this season for Chelsea? What do you think he has gotten right, or what do you think he might have figured out?
I don't know. I can't say
anything. I'm going to force you to be positive, Sam.
I have not liked much of it at all.
Let's not be positive.
This is not a positive at all.
All right.
This is an overwhelming negative. I don't like how he used Havertz in the first couple of games. I don't like how he's used Timo Werner. I don't really like the midfield makeup. I don't like the fact that there's a huge gaping space in front of the centre halves that's never covered. I don't like the fact that the centre halves are pretty error prone and need that cover and therefore make mistakes. I like Reece James. That's been good. And Chilwell's really looking like a real force moving forward with the ball, and he can pick his way down the line and be a real impact player in attack. And I like that. I like the fullbacks. I'll leave it at that. I literally can't do any better. I disagree with so much of what Lampard has done to start the season, and the concerns and the irritations of the Chelsea fans. I absolutely get it.
Well, I want to let's drill down into those then. Having started this by trying to be positive, I'd rather focus on reality. So, like Kai Havertz, there you mentioned. What do you think Lampard isn't getting right? What do you think he should be doing with Kai Havertz?
So he's getting there now. I just got really annoyed on the opening day against Brighton that he ended up playing Havertz on the right flank. Mm-hmm. And I was like, have you literally seen him play before? And he had Loftus-Cheek playing through the middle, who I know he's not a winger, but at least he played a whole season as a winger for Palace under Roy Hodgson on loan. So like, if you're going to put him in their right position, could you just try? And of course, then Havertz plays up front against Liverpool, which I'm roughly okay with, but what I didn't like was the fact that they went down to 10 men, had to make a halftime sub. You took off Havertz. Like, this is going to be an incredibly hard second half for you, and any goal that you score is probably going to be a product of two or three passes and a very quick transition. Guess who the best player to facilitate that is in your team? It's Kai Havertz. You just took him off. And then Timo Werner chopping from left wing to up front to left wing to up front, funneling too much of the play through him rather than letting him get on the end of moves. I don't think he really grasped what Werner is to start with as well. I just looked at it. I just didn't see the logic of what was happening based on what I know of these players. And that's what troubled me.
Do you think that then means that he is likely to be less involved in some of these acquisitions if he's not necessarily playing them in the ideal position, or seems like he lacks some of that familiarity?
Oh, I know for a fact that he wasn't particularly familiar with Kai Havertz before he signed. So, yeah, it's not. These transactions are at least partially going on above his head, which is totally fine because they have a structure, they have a director of football, and they have, you know, this is the way of modern football. A manager isn't out there picking players like he was 10 or 15 years ago. But it's Lampard's duty to figure these players out pretty damn fast, or at least like, you know, not necessarily on the training pitch, because Havertz did only have like a week or so with Chelsea before his debut because of the stupid international break. But just do some research. And, you know, three or four games in, Havertz is playing as a sort of roaming number 10, linking the lines, drifting left and right. Perfect, perfect. Why was he not doing that against Brighton? There's no answer for it. So that's where the frustration comes in.
All right, then I'm going to attempt to end on an optimistic note one more time with this question. I believe I'm correct in saying that this was the largest number of Americans playing in the Champions League, like over the course of like one match day. For you, Sam, is there one particular American that you find yourself enjoying more than others, either in the Champions League or elsewhere?
Well, in this particular match day, I loved the fact that Ethan Horvath just... Well, he got to play,
yeah,
and then he cried.
He did.
And that was really cute. So match day one, Champions League 2020, it was all about Ethan Horvath for me. On a more general note, I mean, I guess it's between the magnificent midfield three, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I still absolutely love watching Pulisic and his clever runs and his ability in transition. And I'm loving the fact that he's been so successful. Because there was a lot of doubts about him in England when he signed in that January, got loaned back, and people looked at his goals and assist tallies and were like, well, you know, he doesn't really do much. Look, he's not a very productive player. He's barely managed to hold it down at Dortmund. The guy's incredible, and I'm really liking the fact that people are going, oh, I kind of misjudged that one. So Havertz, jeez. Pulisic, I'm looking at Havertz on my screen. That's the problem. Pulisic is the one for me for sure.
Do you just have photos of Kai Havertz cycling through on your desktop?
Well, no, it's just because I have the Who Scored lineup graphic mm-hmm. in front of me, just looking at the game against Sevilla. So I was just staring him in the face, even though Pulisic is literally next to him. So there's no excuse.
Is he shirtless, Sam? Is Kai Havertz shirtless in the photo? I feel like that will tell us.
Do you remember what we talked about last time? You know, me and Kai, we go way back.
So, no.
You know, Kai Havertz and I, you know, he said hello to me once. when I was at Leverkusen's training, and it's dangerous to throw those sorts of things around because it could well be true.
I love you, Sam. All right, on that note, on the note of Sam being best friends with Kai Havertz, Sam Tai, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about the first match day of the Champions League. And I appreciate that you're not willing to like make decisions for the entirety of the season based on this one game, but I do appreciate you making sense of everything else as well. One last time, if people want to hear the new show or hear more from you, how can they do so?
Yeah, STI Football on Twitter and Instagram, and it's Ranks FC on your podcast catcher, whatever it is. That's our new show. Formerly BR Football Ranks, now Ranks FC. Same keyword, so you should be okay. Taylor, I was wondering if you might let me have the last word today. That's
of course.
All right. I wanted to take the opportunity to just place on record my appreciation and love for Daryl. I wanted to say that I consider myself to be really lucky, because in 2019 I got to meet Daryl, and this Bundesliga trip that we always talk about every time I'm on the show, it got brought up today. Mm-hmm. That saw myself and Daryl and Taylor collide in Frankfurt and Dusseldorf, and we watched football, we played football, we drank, we ate, and mm-hmm. we enjoyed life. And you know, we stood inside Dusseldorf Stadium at 1 a.m. taking photos, and that marked the end of an amazing trip. We created a bond. I became a TSS listener, an occasional contributor, you know, from that weekend onward. And I've loved Daryl's love and passion for the game from afar ever since meeting him in 2019. And those memories that I have in Frankfurt and Dusseldorf now take on like just a much greater significance in light of the announcement on Monday, which was gut-wrenching. And I'm so sorry. I will treasure those memories forever. And I will always consider myself lucky to have met Daryl and enjoyed his company. So thoughts with you, Daryl. Thoughts with your family. Thoughts with you, Taylor, and to every member of the TSS community who is hurting at the moment.